Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. This time we begin the Techman and Landmark. What you're about to hear is an introduction that I've given you guys thousands of times. People have heard it a lot of getting tired of it, but there's always some new people coming along to wonder, hey, there's something called the Technical Net on Landmark at Sunday night at 8 o'clock. What is it? It's a gathering of the clan. It's the get-together of interested ham radio operators who are willing to teach each other, ask questions and teach each other how all this equipment works and how to make it work better. Let me drop. This will be TechNet number 1588 of the series that began 33 and a fraction years ago, way back in 1982. So it's a fairly popular way of sharing information is what goes on. What we're about to find out tonight is that, is there anybody in the radio world out there that's not watching the Super Bowl? We're about to find that out. But whether or not we get some check-ins, we might possibly are going to be hearing from Jesse, KD2IJD, who's got a very interesting antenna that he has been experimenting with. And there's lots of information we can give him and he can give us. I might even give you some information I found from David, KD2SVZ, who did something very helpful for me this week. I'll be telling you about that. Let's see. Ordinarily, the TechNet, let me drop. We have a rather loose schedule that we follow, in which during the first hour, we take sign-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. They give me their name, their call letters, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. And so for the first hour, we study general questions of that type. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who monitors the mailbag, monitors EchoLink, monitors the chat room. So the various methods by which you can get a hold of John. Snail mail, pigeon droppings, internet, and so on. He collects some questions from people who don't yet have their license or don't yet have the equipment by which they can talk to us directly, but they've had questions. So he selects a few of those. We ran over time on other sections of the net last week, so we didn't get to those questions. So John has got a few of them piled up by now. Let me drop. After John's presentation, we go over to Paul, WS2N, our space expert, who tells us what the latest is with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. And boy, those guys are always doing something interesting, as you're about to find out. Paul will be giving us Space Net Report number 187 of the series. That means he began 187 weeks ago. After that, we discuss anything with the time that's left over. The TechNet usually runs from 8 o'clock Sunday night until midnight, at which time the repeater gets turned off at my request so that we don't go into the wee hours of the morning, which we've done on a few occasions. Some of these people who get really wound up with this kind of information, I don't want to give it up, don't want to stop. I like to see that enthusiasm, but at times you've got to put a limit on it, if you know what I mean. Good job. And once again, from time to time I hear people saying, gee, I don't want to listen to the TechNet, it's always repetition. Really? There's 5,000 different kinds of antennas, so just because we're discussing an antenna doesn't mean we're discussing the same one. There's probably 10 or 15 different ways of measuring and analyzing standing wave ratio. Quite possibly Jesse, KD2IJD, will be showing you one of the less usual ways of measuring standing wave ratio. And to calibrate that kind of a system and to have traceability to the Bureau, there's a number of interesting steps in there. To a crafty amateur, it's all doable. But it's not something that's super easy like falling off a bus. You gotta bury all the individual pieces of physics in order for it to come out right. Okay, so at this time, I'm going to take check-ins. Please give me your call letters and your name, because I'm so darn forgetful, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. I'm going to guess that I've got Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. He's one of our very frequent sign-in people with questions where he tries to stump us. So Joe, give me a confirmation that you do have a question tonight. I think you will. After Joe, anyone else who wants to sign in, give me the call letters and name. Joe first. Go ahead, Joe, for a confirmation.
Correct.
How about that? He's a man of few words tonight. Just where he can get going. Anyone else with questions or comments, give me your call letters and name right now.
Mike, and yes?
Yeah, Mike, let me make sure I got those call letters right. Kilo Charlie Zero, Zebra Romeo Alpha. And are you local, or are you signing in by way of Echo Link from way out there in the hinterlands? Back to you, Mike.
Okay, it's Kilo Charlie Zero, Bravo Radio Alpha, Bravo Romeo Alpha. And no, no, it's just a vanity call. I'm in New York City, in New York.
Very fine, Mike. You sound loud and clear. So if you were coming in from the hinterlands or by Echo Link, I was about to compliment you on the beautiful engineering job you made. You had to go through to make the audio come out so good. Okay, so we got Joe, Mike. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, listening.
WSUN with the space
report.
Ohio. On the deck.
Okay, we had a beautiful double there when I got them both. Paul is double checking with us that he's got a space report tonight. And Rich, K2 UPS, I think it is, out there in Ohio. Rich is signing in. Paul, when you just signed in now, because of the double, I didn't hear the fine details. You're telling us about the space report, which is something we've come to really depend on. You're also saying you have a question tonight, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Just checking in with the space report. That's all. Back to you, Dick.
That's more than enough. No apology required. Okay, so once again, we've got Joe, Mike, and Rich in that order. Anyone else to sign in? Because you do have a question or a comment. Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay. All those hundreds of other possible people that could be signing in are watching the Super Bowl, number 50. And of course, the game is exciting. My son, Chris, KB2IQN, is glued to the tube right now. He's not necessarily a football fan, but by way of his introduction to football at the University of Iowa, he suddenly got great interest in that, to me, destructive game. But that's just my opinion. So, Joe, go easy with us tonight, Joe. You're not supposed to show all of our weak spots and the things that we don't know about. I'm having some fun with Joe. The B2RYY. K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. Carolina's, what is this? What is it? Just saw the squirrel a while ago. Denver's 13. I think the other guy's like a little less. But anyway, I got the thing in the background. My question is, I'm reading a part of a paragraph here in my FCC radio telephone study guide. And it says, the nominal impedance is 75 ohms, 73 ohms, that practices the impedance somewhat higher. And then also says, note that the input impedance decreased as it above ground decreases. Input impedance decreases as distance above ground decreases, so the impedance goes lower. But what it doesn't say is if you're trying to make that dipole work on, say, to match a 50 ohm line directly, either with or without a ballon, do you shorten the elements slightly from the 0.95 typical 0.95% length that you normally come up with the 468 divided by frequency? And is that a linear function? Back to you.
Okay. First of all, a dipole in free space, fed with a good balancing device. In other words, because you've got a transformer-like device at the end of your transmission line that's feeding the two halves of your dipole in a thoroughly differential, symmetric manner. That means at one instant of time, when you're putting plus 1 volt on the right side of the dipole, at the exact same instant of time, you're putting minus 1 volt on the left-hand side of the dipole during that half cycle. And during the next half cycle, it's reversed. So when you have thoroughly balanced differential voltage, and the dipole's really in free space and made out of reasonably thin conductor, and it's roughly 0.95 velocity factor long physical length, so it's now thoroughly resonant, yes, it's a 73 ohm resistive impedance. As you make the dipole longer or shorter, the reactive component builds up 10 times faster than the change in resistance. You make the dipole a little bit shorter, it becomes capacitive super fast. You make it a little bit longer than my stated original comment, and it becomes super inductive real fast. And if you plot the resistive component, the 73 ohms, it goes down from 73 ohms to 71.5 ohms when you make it shorter. At the same time, the reactive component has just gone to 100 ohms of capacitor reactance. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's in that order. You can see this real fast by looking at the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. Let me drop this. Chapter 4 of almost every single issue of the 4 issues or 5 issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook has the explanation. You also have it by way of mic number 1 and mic number 2's website, which you can get a hold of the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, or the proper impedance matching of a dipole. Anyhow, you look at those curves. You'll find that the resistive component, as you make it longer or shorter, changes rather slowly. The reactive component changes with a very steep curve very rapidly. So the biggest thing that happens when you make the dipole shorter or longer is you're generating a reactive impedance. And that's what Mr. Brown and Woodward measured way back in 1945 and published it, and it's been in plain sight in all the good text all of these years. Real measured data, real antennas. Not somebody's attempt at making a computer simulation or a modeling program. And all those modeling programs, as simple as a dipole is, you look at the so-called equation that supposedly models that, complicated as all hell, and that's only just a partial solution to the problem. You want to know what a dipole impedance is, you measure it. Let me drop this. So that's what happens to the dipole in free space. Now you put it in your backyard, and you put it some number of wavelengths above mostly reflecting Earth, and all kinds of things start happening. Not super fast. If you got the dipole, let me say, in the half wavelength in the air, the ground reflection is not a major factor. You start bringing the dipole real close to ground, you're getting a very high reflection from that ground for the signal that goes straight down. And when that signal comes back, it's been through a certain length of free space, therefore it's got a phase shift to it. So the impedance can go around. If you plotted the impedance on a Smith chart, as you bring your dipole closer and closer to ground, you would see it starting to make circles. A third of the way out, so to speak, from the center of the Smith chart, and you're generating circles of reflective signals from the ground, and you put other dipoles nearby, higher and lower in frequency, on the same frequency, and change the length, again, you're going to get interactions. Now, if your dipole is 73 ohms, and you've got a 50 ohm cable, and you would lose a lot of sleep over that, that's something like a 1.4 standing wave ratio. That's an apparent loss of 2/10 of a dB. I wouldn't lose a whole lot of sleep over that, particularly if you've got an antenna tuner. A good antenna tuner these days can take almost any phase angle. Let me drop it. Almost any phase angle of at least a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, and at certain phase angles, it probably can tolerate a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio. A good antenna tuner. And the antenna tuner does not waste power. All that reflected energy, because your antenna is not an ideal impedance match at the end of your transmission, all that reflected energy, when the antenna tuner is properly tuned, all that reflected energy gets re-reflected forward in phase with the signal your transmitter is producing right now. It wastes nothing. You get a little bit of extra loss of the transmission line because the signal is bouncing back and forth, a portion of it. So when it comes to impedance for dipole, and what's a tolerable standing wave ratio, depending on what rig you're using and whether or not you've got an antenna tuner. There's a lot of variables involved. But impedance versus length and impedance versus altitude is a complicated function. It sure would be nice if shortening the dipole would make the 70 ohms come down to 50. I say no. In general, no. At a particular altitude or particular amount of reflection from your ground and a horizontal or a vertical polarized dipole, yes, you can find solutions like that. But you're going to have to dig a little deeper. You're not going to just fall into that one as easy as you'd like, Joe. Impedance matching, there are people who have spent a good fraction of their life studying impedance matching, looking at a well-tuned vector network analyzer and finding out what's really happening with the antenna when I do this and when I do that, and why is it doing that. There's more to it than first meets the eye. I'm not trying to discourage you. I'm just trying to let you know that you're walking through, it's not a minefield, but you're walking through something that's a little more complicated than we all wish it was. Maybe that helps a little bit, Joe, and follow with some further questions. W2RYY, the guy is trying to stump us again tonight. K2RYW, you got it, Joe.
up here, just trying to just add to my, you know, knowledge I already know. But if I understand right, as you decrease the length of the dipole, the impedance is going to start to go up approximately. I know that, you know, you told me the resistive components, reactive components also, but in general, does it start to increase the impedance as you shorten the antenna length?
That's a good question, Joe, and the answer is generally yes. And the idea, we'd like the antenna to be a 50 or a 70 ohm pure resistor and no reactants. As you make the antenna shorter or longer, the equivalent circuit of the antenna is a resistor in series with a box that we're going to call the reactor. And that reactor is inductive if the antenna is longer than it should be, and that reactor is capacitive if the antenna is shorter than it's supposed to be. So that reactance is in series with the resistance of the antenna, the radiation resistance, and yes, the overall impedance is going to go up. The overall impedance is that that square root formula, R squared plus X squared, and you take the square root of the whole thing. That is the magnitude of the impedance when you have a resistor and a reactor in series with each other. And yes, because the reactance in the ideal world starts off at zero, and the reactance is going to start going up, negative or positive in phase, but it's going to start going up, your overall impedance does go up. But whenever there is any reactive component to the impedance, the reflected signal from the antenna starts happening pretty fast. So making the impedance go up is not necessarily good. If you've got, if you happen to be using open wire line of 200 ohms impedance, 300 ohms impedance, let's make it 300 ohms, and your dipole starts off at 75 ohms, a naive person would say, well, if I make the dipole shorter, it becomes reactive. The total impedance, I can make it equal 300 ohms. It might have 240 ohms of capacitor reactance in series with some number of ohms of resistive component, and yes, the overall impedance is 300 ohms. But because you've got that great big reactive component, even though the total impedance is 300, because there's that great big reactive component, which is 90 degrees out of phase, transmission lines don't like that. In general, transmission lines, unless you do some kind of stub tuning, antenna matching, whatever, unless you do something funny, most transmission lines don't like to see a reactive load. The reactive load, from the transmission line's point of view, absorbs no energy. Whatever energy you put into a capacitive reactant, you're going to get every bit of it back. It doesn't get absorbed, it doesn't get radiated. So reactive impedance, even though the total impedance goes up, usually it's bad, Joe. That may help a little bit to remove a little bit of the confusion of what's going on here. And by the way, there's a lot of people in the boat that you're going through right now, in the moat that you're going through. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Well, the only thing I can do with measuring the antenna, I don't have a network analyzer or the availability of getting a hold of one. So the only thing I have is really an antenna bridge that will tell me the best return loss when looking into a 50 ohm impedance. And if I'm looking into a transmission line, obviously it's the same thing. I'm seeing the best match of the antenna as it starts to approach 50 ohms. It seems to be a better match into the transmission line. But you're saying there's other things to consider besides that, because if it becomes too reactive, that's bad.
I'm not sure of the exact mathematics of this, but if I had an impedance of an antenna that's 20 ohms resistive and 30 ohms reactive, you would think that you add the two together and you get a 50 ohm impedance. Well, by way of that square root of the sum of the squares formula, R squared plus X squared, square root of the whole thing, by way of that formula, it ain't going to come out 50 ohms. But even though you can make, by adjusting the resistive and reactive component in that example, equal 50 ohms total impedance, that ain't good. Because the reactive component, the 30 ohms of reactance in my silly example, with 20 ohms of resistance, that reactive component absorbs no energy. Whatever energy you put into it on the first half cycle comes back as a reflected signal. So any reactant, in general, at the tail end of a transmission line is going to give you some grief if you haven't done something to correct for it. Now, the reactance is not a showstopper. If you're willing to put in an impedance matching device, a stub at just the right location, a coaxial stub, there's a zillion ways that you can take the complex impedance of a less than desirable antenna where the resistive component an antenna analyzer, some kind of a machine that you can either build or buy, which measures the resistant component and the reactive component. If you know the numbers, and if you know how to handle the right kind of mathematics, or use the right lookup table, or simply go to the Berkeley program, Google the word Berkeley plus impedance match. You get this beautiful program that you don't have to download. You just give it the information as to what you've got, and it'll tell you what's the ideal solution. It'll give you 16 solutions. Choose the one you like. So the fact that your antenna is less than ideal and resistive or reactive component, there's a zillion ways you can change the antenna to make an improvement. There's a zillion ways you can do something to the transmission line at the end to make all that standing wave ratio disappear, at least at one frequency. So your problem here, Joe, is that the number of possible solutions is so high, and the words that people use to describe impedances and impedance matching and reactances and resonances and visual and whatever, all the words they use complicate the issue, and it scares the hell out of people. If you're willing to dig into it, there is a rational solution to all of this. So you don't have to lose a whole lot of sleep because your antenna has an impedance you don't like. There, in some cases, are awfully simple solutions, at least at one frequency at a time. W2LYY, K2LAW.
Okay, well, you make it sound like maybe a little more complicated than it probably really is, but that's the only instrumentation I have to go by. It's just really return loss bridge. I have no other way of measuring the performance of the antenna. So if I get the antenna to match the 50-ohm transmission line, apparently by having the best return loss or somewhere near so, I don't know if that, from what you're saying now, apparently it seems like that's not really the best thing to do.
Hey, you've used my words, Joe, in a very logical way, and you've come to a conclusion that's worse than reality. Assuming your antenna analyzer, your impedance bridge, can really measure reflected energy ratio, like you would with a bird watt meter. Assume you really know how much power is going forward and how much power is coming back. And you do whatever tinkering you do to the antenna to make the reflected power go towards zero. You make the impedance look better and better. You make the visual better and better. By definition, you didn't even know it when you did that. You were making the antenna get closer and closer to a pure 50-ohm resistor, and you were making the reactive component go to zero. That's the only way you're going to make the reflected power look good in order to balance your impedance bridge. When you balance that impedance bridge, at least at that frequency you're operating at, the transmission line you're looking to is presenting a 50-ohm pure resistive load. Your impedance bridge is telling you the truth as far as reflected power is concerned. And when it goes into balance, you're at home plate, Joe. It's good news. There's almost no way I know of that a properly operated... Let me drop this. The good news, Joe, is that there's almost no way that a properly operating impedance bridge can be balanced and your answer is wrong. It's almost always right on. You're at home plate. So if it tells you you got good news, you got good news. If it tells you you got bad news, higher or lower tuning. nearby are going to give you some interaction. And in many cases, if it's a pure fan-like dipole built in the conventional manner, the amount of interaction is not alarming. It's annoying. The amount of interaction might take your basic dipole that was giving you a 1.2 vizwar, and you add some of the other elements to the fan dipole, and your basic element went from 1.2 to 1.4 vizwar. That may happen, and you may consider that annoying. That's not a showstopper, and there's lots of solutions to that. In many cases, because of the reactance of another nearby antenna, which primarily affects the reactive component, and you can now generate a brand new positive or negative reactance by making your dipole longer or shorter. So in that case, because nearby antennas create their disturbance primarily in the reactive component, nowhere near as much in the resistive component. Let me drop. So as you're building up this fan-like dipole arrangement, and you just added another element, and your basic element used to be a 1.2 vizwar, and it's now a 1.4 in my example. And because that extra standing wave ratio is usually more reactive error than resistive error, let's assume now that the nearby element made your antenna look a little bit too inductive, your basic element. And now you shorten your basic element to make it more capacitive, and the capacitive reactance you've just created in the basic element will cancel most of the inductive reactance you created by placing the nearby element nearby. So as long as you're willing to readjust lengths, yes, in that particular case, you get a better impedance match by adjusting length because the nearby antennas created reactance, not resistance. In general, a dipole all by itself, you can't change the resistive component very much by changing the length. You can only change the reactive component. And any reactance you create in a dipole all by itself, in general, is bad. But in the case of a fan dipole, where your nearby element made an inductive reactance to your basic element, and now you can make the basic element more capacitive to cancel it, you got a win-win there. You see what's going on there, Joe? I was misinterpreting some of your early words. You're closer to doing the right thing than I expected. W-A-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Well, we all try, don't we, Dick?
Good ham radio operators are an amazingly good tinkerer. I've often said modern-day antenna design includes an awful lot of tinkering in the real world. You can model the daylights out of it with your computer programs, and you think you're going to get a solution. Sometimes, yes, and some of the really good high-performance antennas, the antenna modeling programs, in my opinion, do not work anywhere near as well as you all want to believe they do. The true ham radio tinkerer will find a solution super fast in many cases. And as such, the bottom line is if you want to hire an antenna engineer who is really worth his salt, he's got good common sense and knows how to get his way out of the paper bag, so to speak, there's a good chance you're going to hire a ham radio operator if you need an antenna designing engineer. Tinkering is definitely a very effective way of doing it. You don't have to use post-computer optimization. Your computer program is trying to model the real world, and you never give it enough of the real-world information. Good job. So the real world into a computer modeling program, no matter how good the program is, because you've given it partial information and partial accuracy, you're going to get an answer that's in the ballpark. But if you want to get to home plate, you're going to have to do some post-computer optimization. You're going to go back to tinkering. You could have started off with tinkering in the first place if you had a little bit of common sense and some past experience. That's where real antenna engineering takes place, from my point of view. I've done it that way as a consultant for the last 15 years and as an engineer for the previous 30 years, and for me, it worked extremely well. Not everybody. And you're not going to get success all the time, but if you dig in and find out why it didn't work, it's usually another very good piece of information there. Okay, we're going to go over to Mike next. KC0, Baker Romeo Alpha. Go right ahead, Mike. K2RAW, my name is Dick.
All right, Dick. Finally, you actually jumped in here. I've been listening for so long. Listen, I have a question. Let me ID myself anyway, even though you did, KC0BRA. I'm located in the Bronx in Frog's Neck area. I just have a quick question. It could be a quick, it could be a long question. I right now have, this is regarding an HF antenna, and I have a 9-to-1 un-un, and I have a 53-foot length of wire, and I have a tuner. and I am resonant on a lot of frequencies where I don't have to use the tuner. What I'm trying to do at this point is two things. One, I'm going to get a fan dipole, which I'm going to try to do. But I have this going up into a tree. Now, it's inverted. It goes up on an angle. It's like a sloper. One side goes on a sloper, and I have a counterpoise on this. I have a 53-foot radiator wire and a 36-foot counterpoise that is going cross-laying on a roof. I am challenged in the city. Let me drop for 1 second. Okay, I'm challenged in the city with the where you could put antennas, so I have a tree that it goes up to. And right now I have a 53-foot length going in there. I'm going to extend this length to 98.5, which the company recommends, to give me the next length with a fairly decent SWR across the bands. My question is, will that make an increase on my signal with the length? And that's one question. The other question is, let's say, for instance, will that make my 10-meter side actually a physically bigger antenna, or does it physically use still the same amount of size, as in it finds the resonance on that frequency? I guess I may not be asking the question right, but if I make that antenna and it's going to be used on 10 meters, it's going to be used on 12, 15, 80, 20, 40, all of that stuff, will that physically give me more gain or bigger size antenna with that? Or would it physically make no difference, just making it non-resonant, less resonant, and it wouldn't be more efficient, as in making it longer?
K6DPZ. Dick, can I come with a comment, or am I off the tech net also?
I was told you're definitely off, that's how to say, Al, and we were given very specific instructions in that. I may not agree, but those are the instructions we were given. Mike, you've got a very interesting set of situations there. First of all, the fact that your antenna is not purely horizontal, purely vertical, and it's slanted, don't let that trouble you at all. The exact slant angle of your antenna makes very little difference, because as that signal goes out into the ionosphere, it gets reflected and goes on to your buddy that you want to talk to in 50 miles away or 3,000 miles away. That signal, as it goes through the ionosphere, almost always gets twisted in polarization. You may launch a pure vertical signal, and by the time it twists four times and gets to your buddy in England, it's now a horizontal signal. So don't worry about slant angle. Let me drop. Your next question is really about, you didn't use the right words, but you're really into impedance matching. Depending on what you do with the antenna, longer, shorter, higher, lower, slanted higher, up and down, and bigger counterpoise and non-bigger counterpoise, and whether or not you've got a higher or lower standing wave ratio, these are minor details of impedance matching. Assuming you're using a fairly low loss transmission line, as long as you do whatever you've got to do with your antenna tuner, with stubs, changing lens, changing positions, and whatever, as long as you do something to make the transmitter see a pure 50 ohm load, then of the 100 watts coming out of your transmitter, 98 of those watts are going to be radiated into space. Once you do the proper impedance matching by all the techniques you're going to use, all of the power you put in that antenna is going to be radiated somewhere in space. Okay? Now what determines how much gain you're going to get into your desired direction? Let me drop. How much gain you get into a desired direction is strictly a function of what antenna pattern have you just created by way of the length, the shape, the orientation of your antenna, by way of the reflection of the building, the ground, the trees, and everything else. You've got various amounts of gain in various directions, and you would like a simple lengthening or shortening of the antenna to make the gain go up or down. Almost always the answer is no. You're going to be radiating almost all the power you've got. For you to truly make the gain significantly higher, like 3 dB higher, half S unit and a well-calibrated S meter, to make the antenna gain go up by 3 dB, you must invest in real estate. You're going to put another parasitic element there, a dipole, a director or a reflector. You're going to start moving in the Yagi direction. You're going to put in a great big reflective ground screen so that it looks like a corner reflector, if you know what I mean. To really really make the gain go up by 3 dB. You have to double the effective capture area of the antenna. You can't do that by simple making it 5 feet longer and 5 feet shorter. That doesn't change the gain. I can take, let me give you the example I've used quite often. Let me drop. If I'm setting up a pure, simple, half-wave, 80-meter dipole, and I've set it a half wavelength above the ground, an 80-meter dipole is 132 feet long. And because my New York City restricted property in the Bronx, doesn't have anywhere near enough real estate for me to set up a 132-foot dipole, I make it 32 feet long instead of 132 feet long. Good common sense would tell you, boy, I'm going to have one quarter of the capture area. I've got one quarter of the lens. It's going to be terrible. Absolutely not. As long as you resonate that antenna and do a good impedance match, it's going to be difficult. It's going to have 1,000 ohms of reactive impedance that you've got to get rid of. But as long as you resonate it and impedance match it, that 32-foot dipole will have the exact same gain as the full 132-foot dipole. The exact same gain, the exact same antenna pattern within half a dB, which is a very small fraction of an S-unit, 1/12 of an S-unit, if you know what I mean. As long as you resonate the antenna, every bit of the power you put into it gets radiated into space. And making it from a half wavelength long to a tenth of a wavelength long has almost no change in the antenna pattern. You're radiating the same amount of power. Let me drop. That's a 32-foot long dipole at 80 meters. It's going to be high and do like crazy. You tune 50 kc up the band, and now you've got to readjust all the dials in the antenna tuner. It's a very, very narrow band antenna. It goes up in Q. It goes down in bandwidth when you make it too short, but re-resonate it. But at least on that frequency where you re-resonate it and re-impedance match, 98% of the power is going to be radiated with the exact same pattern. Of course that's crazy. You read the appropriate chapter of the so-called infinitesimal dipole in the Bible of Antennas, the antenna book by John Krauss, W-H-A-K, McGraw-Hill, 1950. The book is called Antennas. You read the section on the infinitesimal dipole. You'll find that as long as you impedance match any length dipole you like, you're going to get the exact same gain, the exact same radiation efficiency. Ain't that crazy? Until you make the dipole multiple half wavelengths long, then you're going to get a more lobey antenna pattern, and now you're starting to change the gain. You've invested in real estate. But simple changes where you think the gain is going to be up and down, it doesn't. I know that's opposite of common sense. You've got to ask some more questions on this one, Mike. And you're allowed to come back and ask him as many times as you like, because there's a lot of people in your boat. KC0, Baker Romeo Alpha, from the Bronx, K2RW. How is the flight with you, Mike?
Yeah, thank you. That gave me some information, and most of that I knew already, which was good. But I also, can I just phrase in a little thing? I don't know if I have enough time, because I'm thinking about going with a... Right now I'm using the NFED with 53 feet and a 36-foot counterpoise. I was thinking about raising it, bringing it up to a 98, which is into a second tree, which is going to bring me another 35 foot higher, which is great, which I know that's going to work better for me no matter what. It's also, you know, I have a tuner. My thing is it better for me to keep that NFET or to make a fan dipole? Because no matter what, the fan dipole is going to go up in a tree, one side, and the other side is going to lay flat on a roof. Well, it's going to go across the roof. Would you think a fan dipole would do better, or you would think that NFED would do better? Because I'm doing very well with the NFED. I have a current balun up on a roof, about 4 feet from the antenna, which is stopping my RF from coming down. It knocked all my common mode noise out. Everything is working well. I'm getting contacts like crazy because the antenna is 5 stories in the air. My question is, do you think a fan dipole would do better than this NFED antenna that would be 98.5 feet, compared to, you know, physically the right size for the bands? You think because this is a question that I'm having with a lot of my buddies, and they're telling me the fan dipole is going to blow away the other one. Meanwhile, it's not going to be as high as the other one. Would that be a better antenna since it's actually two sides of an antenna? Because that's what I keep hearing. I'm using one side of an antenna, but I have a counterpoise. So it's not one-sided antenna, but just real quick, if you could just touch base with that. I'm sorry to hold anything up here.
Dick, K2UPS has a comment.
Yeah, we're going to go over to Rich in a minute, because he's been down this road. there's nothing magic about the way you feed your radiator. If I was talking about a half-wavelength piece of wire, I can break it in the center and feed it as a center-fed half-wave dipole. If I'm smart enough in the way I do the impedance matching and balancing, I can feed it 10% off-center, 50% off-center, or at the output open end. Whether you feed it at the end or feed it at the center is your choice. You got to go through extra impedance matching criteria when you feed it at the end, but the amount of energy you put into that radiator once you finally do the impedance matching and resonating is the same. The signal you get out in space is the same. Whether or not you're doing it with a counterpoise or without a counterpoise, as long as you properly impedance match, when you resonate, you radiate all of the energy, as long as you resonate and give the proper impedance matching. Part of your question was, if I do this or that, I'm changing the altitude of the antenna. Now you're talking. Do anything to change the altitude of the antenna. Almost always, more altitude is better. You're further away from the ground. Your amount of signal you're putting out to the horizon, where the real DX signals are, is going to get stronger because you're lowering that radiation load. So whether you do it with antenna A, end fed, or antenna B, a fan dipole, is strictly your choice. Let me drop. Whichever you use, you're going to be radiating the exact same amount of power. If your center of radiation is higher off the ground, you're going to be better off. Lower signal, lower angle of radiation, stronger signals on the horizon, more DX. So you've got more knobs you can twiddle here than first meets the eye, Mike. Now, the guy who's twiddled a lot of those knobs because he does an awful lot of portable operating with simple antennas he sets up in the field, and many of them are end-fed, and he does the impedance matching to it on his portable operations, and I've witnessed some of that going on, is this guy Rich, KTUPS. I'm going to guess he's in Ohio right now, traveling toward us or away from us. KTUPS, tell us what you've done along these lines and what you've seen, Rich. KTUPS, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
KTUPS Mobile, how about Pennsylvania right now? Near Washington, Pennsylvania, southwest corner, heading back home, trying to beat the storm. End-fed wires with a 9-to-1, I love those antennas. Most of the time, I run a 31-foot length wire or so, when I'm portable. I just recently started using the 53-foot length. I wonder, Mike, if that chart that you're referring to is, you got it off of ballondesigns.com, off of their webpage, because that's where I was trying different lengths, too. You had asked, Dick, if making the wire longer to 98.5 feet will give you more gain. In my opinion and my testing that I've done on different length wires, because your wire isn't perfectly straight, because it's set up like an inverted Z or an inverted L or got bends in it, you're not really going to see gain because you already have omnidirectional radiation. You don't really have gain in any one direction. The only time you're going to get gain, you start to see gain by increasing the length of the wire, is if it was straight and set up like a real and said long wire where it's multiple wavelengths long. But then instead of picking up some broadside of the antenna, you're going to get directivity in the length of it. So where you're picking up is going to change. But in your instance, I would not go with a fan dipole. I'd stick with what's working well for you with that 53-foot end set. You only have to support it, you know, at one place. You got one wire up there, fan dipole. Now you're going to have wires running all over the place. More support points, bad weather, maybe part of it will come down. Who knows? I think you got something really good working. It's a proven winner for you, and I would stick with that. Take back to that.
Fantastic, Rich. You're hearing it from the horse's mouth for a guy who's been there and done that. Mike, if you've got any further questions for what Rich just told you, go ask him right now. K0BRA. Make sure you wait for the beeps. K2RIW. You got it, Mike.
All right, thank you. He answered the question. You guys both answered exactly what I was thinking, and I had people arguing with me, telling me the fan dipole is going to do better. Yes, I did get that information from Ballon Designs. I have the whole PDF sitting here, and I have the different lengths of wire, and they've been working extremely well for me. The only problem I had was a little bit of RFI, and I put a current Ballon in there, and that helped the RFI, brought my noise level down, my noise floor dropped down, everything worked beautiful, and I'm enjoying it very much right now. And thank you very much for the information, because that's what I was saying. Now I'm going to go with the longer length of wire, the 98 feet, which is going to get me another 35 to 40 feet higher. I am a happy individual. And yes, I have an antenna tuner, so if it's a little bit off, it's all good. But I've been very happy with the length of the 53 feet. I went from the 36 to the 53, and it made major improvements on 80 meters and most of my other bands. But thank you very much, and thank you for the time, guys. I really appreciate it. This makes me feel much better, and I think I'm going to put that fan dipole on hold. Thank you very much. KC0BRA, thank you, Dick, and any other station out there in the Mobile.
Yeah, Mike, there's a chance we've saved you some money. We've saved you some man hours. And you're a hell of a lot better off than you know. You tune across the 20-meter band any day of the week. And I don't care what subject you ask on the subject of antennas and transmission lines. Talk to five guys and you're going to get 10 opinions. The amount of recycled old wives' tales on the subject of standing wave ratio, antenna tuning, antenna resonating, antenna altitude, antenna gain. My goodness. The fact that you've heard a lot of conflicting opinions. With further experience, you're going to find out that's just the way it is on the 20-meter band when you ask anybody for an opinion on antennas and transmission lines. Nobody. You're never going to get a compendium where everybody agrees. Talk to the guys who have been there and done it, and you're a lot better off than you think. And no matter how bad the biswar appears to be, as long as you can find out how much of it's resistive and how much of it's capacitive, you can make an impedance-matching device that's going to cost you $5. That's going to make the problem go away by way of the Berkeley program, if you know what I mean. So resonate first, then it will radiate. And once you do that correctly, 98% of your power is going somewhere in space. And where, let me drop this. And where it goes in space is primarily a function of how high is the antenna, how near is the ground, and whether or not the piece of wire is absolutely straight or it's got a bend in it. If you study the change in antenna pattern as opposed to an inverted V bend in your infed wire, you'll find out that the change in antenna pattern is extremely minor until you start going, you know, drastic differences like a 90-degree bend or 120-degree bend. So don't worry. The RF energy is reasonably blind. It doesn't see those bends and wiggles in that piece of wire that your eye sees. It's a lot more forgiving, if you know what I mean. Come back and let us know how this works out as you go further with this project, Mike. You're solving a very difficult problem, putting those kind of HF antennas into a very urban environment of the Bronx. Okay, let's see, the next person who signed in, who was it? K2UPS. Hey, Rich, you've got all the answers. Why in the world would you have to have a question? K2UPS, out there in Pennsylvania, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, K2UPS Mobile. And one last comment from Mike is, like it says in that PDF chart that he was looking at, those lengths are not set in stone. Depending on how the antenna is installed, what it's near, you may have to lengthen or shorten it a little bit to get optimum results. But those are good, you know, starting points. And I found that out myself. My first time using a 53-foot and fed wire, I was not able to ground mounted like I normally do due to 30 inches of snow in my uncle's backyard, so I had to strap it onto the back of the Jeep, which normally works fine for 40 through 6 meters. For some reason, the 83-foot wire, I mean the 53-foot wire, when the antenna was mounted on the Jeep, would load up on 160 through 10, but not 80 meters. I don't know why, but that's something I have to check into. But ground mounted, it worked fine. I even had 160-meter contacts on the last contest last weekend in January, using a 53-foot end foot wire, 30-foot vertical, 22-foot horizontal from the top, no ground radios, just a 100-foot piece of coax, and I was making contacts up and down the East Coast. One call, they came right back to me, so that was kind of cool. Let me let it drop, and I'll give you my question. Okay, about 2 weeks ago, I was down at the beach with some friends doing some portable operations. Yes, it was a little chilly out, and we decided to operate some inside his car. It was a little warmer, and then switch between two antennas. He had a homebrew go-to-way vertical that he could, with a loading coil at the bottom that he could adjust, and a radio that was attached to a cyclone fence, and I had my usual end-fed wire attached to my Jeep. And we were making different comparisons, and I noticed that his S-meter that he was using was installed after the antenna tuner. And I told him, you can't do that, that it has to be between the radio and the antenna tuner.
your antenna is less than an ideal 50-ohm resistor at the end of your transmission line. If it's anything else, lesser or more resistive ohms, or any amount of reactive ohms, you're going to get a predictable amount of reflected signal from that antenna. That reflected signal comes back to the output end of your antenna tuner, and when the antenna tuner is tuned up just right, that reflected signal gets re-reflected forward in phase with the signal your transmitter is making right now, and therefore it all gets radiated. If your feed line is low in loss, it all gets radiated. Now on that feed line on the output end of the antenna tuner, yes, the impedance is some crazy number. Depending on where along the line you make the measurement, you can get all kinds of resistive values and reactive values, but they all have the exact same visor. If you're using a directional power meter, like a Berg watt meter, on the output end, you know that your transmitter produces 100 watts. You might see 150 watts going forward and 50 watts coming back. And yes, at first it's a little bit difficult to understand, but all that reflected power is being re-reflected forward. And by the way, the numbers don't come out that round with reflected power. Let me drop this. So, is the information you measure with your Berg watt meter, for instance, on the output end of your antenna tuner, is that information useful? Absolutely. It's telling you a truth. However, interpreting that truth takes a little bit of English. Takes quite a bit of a little bit deeper understanding of what's going on in the RF world with reflective power. So, if you're smart enough, you can measure the power on the output end. You just got to be careful how you use that. You may see 150 watts going forward. You know damn well your transmitter is only making 100 watts. And yes, you're only radiating 98 of those watts. You're not radiating the 150. You're not getting something for nothing here. There's no free lunch, if you know what I mean. You're not violating the laws of physics. So you're going to have energy bouncing back and forth on that output transmission line and the output end of the antenna tuner. That's the reason why you see these crazy numbers. Bigger numbers going forward and some significant number coming back. But those are real numbers. If you're smart enough, it's telling you the truth, Rich. You just got to be careful how you use it. You got to dig a little deeper. I wonder if that helps. KTUPS, K2RIW, the TechNet.
A little bit, but they're not trying to measure the power. They were just using a SWR meter. It is not a power meter. It was an old, I think, a Lafayette, where you have to, like, calibrate it one way and then forward and throw it in reverse and take another reading. It was like a relative reading meter, but it's not measuring power. It's just SWR. But, I mean, I was still thinking that has to be put in front of the tuner. So the last thing to be connected up to the antenna is the tuner, whether the feed line or not. But the SWR bridge belongs between the radio and the antenna tuner. And they were both saying, no, you can use it there. And because his antenna was close to a 50-ohm load on its own, and mine was probably 1,000 ohms or less because it was an MFET, the meter was giving us different readings, and he's trying to tell me that his antenna was more efficient that way. And I'm like, no, but you're taking readings, trying to make a judgment with them, and your readings are not good, valid readings. That was my point. But they were measuring power, they're just measuring using an SWR bridge now.
Okay. There's some yeses and nos here, Rich. If you're using your SWR bridge on the input end of the antenna tuner, and you adjust the dials in the antenna tuner so that the apparent standing wave ratio between the transmitter and the antenna tuner, and you make that go to 1:1, you've done the right thing. You now put the antenna, the VISWAR meter, maybe it's a voltage detector, forward and reverse, and whatever, you put it on the output end of the antenna tuner. The VISWAR you need there, if the VISWAR measuring device was thoroughly linear, as you adjust the antenna tuner, the VISWAR you measure on the output end of the coax does not change. Of course, that sounds crazy. In other words, the VISWAR on the output end of the antenna tuner is determined only by what the antenna itself is doing on the end of that transmission line. Your adjustment of the antenna tuner does not change the standing wave ratio downrange on that cable. It just allows you to impedance match it back to the transmitter. But here's another piece of good news. If you're looking at nothing but forward power as you do the zeroing of your VISWAR meter on the output end of the antenna tuner, let me drop it. parallel meters, using one on the input end of the antenna tuner and one on the output end. And as you adjust your antenna tuner, you'll see something very magic that happens. You adjust the dial just right, the input visual meter will go to 1:1. That's good. The output visual meter will show you maximum forward voltage. If you just use it as a voltage measuring device, whenever you adjust the antenna tuner correctly, no matter where you are on the line, the voltage on the line measured at that point will go to maximum when you adjust the antenna tuner correctly. You're getting the maximum amount of power going forward, the maximum amount of power being radiated, the best impedance match of the transmitter, as the antenna tuner is tuned just right. The output voltage goes to the highest number. You're peaking that voltage. At first, that sounds crazy. But as long as your visual meter on the output end can handle the big dynamic range, and you are measuring that visual forward and reverse ratio, it will always be the exact same visual, but you want to maximize the voltage going forward, and you're doing that automatically when you adjust the antenna tuner for a good input match on the antenna tuner. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, Joe. I mean, Rich. It's good conservation of energy, believe it or not. K2UPS, mobile. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yes, it does make more sense. And then, to delve a little bit more into what antenna would, let's say, be more efficient. When he was using his, and he had an automatic antenna tuner hooked up to his radio, when he would hit the button to tune it for his radio, it would tune it very quickly because it was pretty close to a 50-ohm load. When he tried to tune it on mine, it would click and click and click and take a while before it finally found a match. And he was trying to say that without showing that my antenna was a better, that his antenna, the quarter wave vertical, was a better match than my MFET. And I'm like, no, because if you're giving it the right impedance that the antenna wants to see at that feed point, because I'm feeding at the end on 20 meters, it's looking at, you know, maybe 1,000 ohms impedance as opposed to the middle, it might be 50. But as long as the antenna's seeing that, that's not going to affect the efficiency. You know, you're not trying to feed it with a 50-ohm load into a 1,000-ohm antenna, because that's what the tuner is matching. And just because it maybe took the tuner a little while to find the match, I don't think that would have any relation whether which was more efficient.
You're 100% right, Rich. The antenna itself, now the word efficiency, there's a lot of different words we can use here for efficiency, but if my definition of antenna efficiency is I put 100 watts out of my transmitter into the system, and if 98 of those watts eventually get radiated by my antenna, I call that efficiency. And whether you did it with a 50-ohm antenna or a 1,000-ohm antenna, with proper impedance matching so that all that power is being radiated, the efficiency will be the same, unless you've made a huge difference in length, altitude, or whatever. The gain will be the same. The signal you're radiating to that guy in England is going to sound the same. If they're both vertical antennas at the same altitude, one's a 50-ohm impedance, the other's a 1,000-ohm impedance. You're still radiating 100 watts with the broadside of that piece of wire. It's sending that exact same signal, the exact same number of watts into space. And so the efficiency of radiation and the signal you put into that S-meter in England is going to be the same. You know what I mean? So the fact that it's a 1,000-ohm antenna, because you're feeding the output end of it as an end-fed wire, that just gives you a slight increase in difficulty of impedance matching, and your antenna tuner's got to click some more. But when it finds the solution, assume it's got enough antenna range to do that, you're still going to be radiating 98 of those 100 watts you're generating, if you know what I mean there, Rich. So you're a hell of a lot more correct than he knew about. K2UPS, in my opinion, K2LIW in the TechNet.